order, please. Archbishop, thank you very much indeed for coming. We're grateful to you. I think you know what the committee is about and the issues that we're faced with. I wonder, would you like to make an opening statement before we launch the questions at you?
Thank you, Chairman. I'm very grateful to the committee for this opportunity to make some introductory remarks. The committee will have had copies of the submission which the Archbishop of York and myself have sent, which express the views of the bishops. So the committee will know that we welcome the draft bill as providing an opportunity to debate reform of the House of Lords. And our starting point has been to ask what will best serve Parliament and the nation. In a bicameral legislature, what kind of second chamber do we actually need, which provides a restrained but effective check and balance to the House of Commons? We agree that some reform of the Lords is long overdue, not least in solving the problem of an ever-increasing membership and ever-increasing pressure on seats, which we on the bishops' benches have noted particularly in the last year or so. But we also see a compelling case for retaining a second chamber distinctive from the House of Commons in composition and powers. And our view has been that a second chamber should be composed so as to ensure the just use of power entrusted to the government of the day, the government which commands a majority in the House of Commons, so as to ensure true and impartial accountability, scrutinising and revising government legislation with a degree of independence not possible in the House of Commons, and third, so as to represent the diversity of what I and others have called non-partisan civil society and intellectual life. Our concern is that the nature of the second chamber should be shaped by considerations about its purpose, considerations of this sort. The proposal in the draft bill to have a much smaller second chamber, which is entirely or almost entirely elected, would, we believe, bring about a fundamental change, producing a second house which is only doubtfully likely to secure those objectives. It's important, we believe, that all members of the second chamber should have a full understanding of the diversity of civil society. And that is where we believe the bishops' contribution comes in. Bishops, of course, are not life peers. They are peers of Parliament. They sit in the House until they retire as diocesan bishops. They serve only while they are in harness in the diocese, and they bring to bear there their experience of all aspects of civil society in their own diocesan area. And it has been said that they are, in effect, the only members of the upper house who have something like constituencies. I would draw attention on the part of the committee to the appointment procedure for bishops, which is something not always widely understood. An appointments procedure which involves elected members of our synod, which involves extensive consultation with civil society in the vacant diocese, which approaches and draws opinions from a large number of people in, for example, civic administration, education, and a number of other community locations. So the procedure of appointment is one which takes for granted that a bishop has a role, a very visible role, in civil society. And one of the things we hear most often in the Crown Nominations Commission from non-church representatives from the diocese who've been consulted is we want somebody who will, I quote, speak for the city, speak for the county, speak for the region. And that's not just a matter of empty words, as I think shown by the number of diocesan bishops who have served and continue to serve in regional partnerships, often in the chair of regional partnerships. The rooted presence of the Church of England in every community of England, the committed membership of nearly 1 million regular weekly attenders, does give bishops personal access to a very wide spread of civil organisation and experience, perhaps wider than is enjoyed by many comparable public figures. Their personal contribution to the work of the House of Lords, therefore, draws not on partisan policy, but on that direct experience, as well as engagement generally with questions of ethics, morality, and faith. Bishops know every church in their diocese, they know the communities they serve, and they serve far more people than church attendance in the narrow sense represents. They take part in civic ceremonies. They visit and are known by hospitals, care homes, the armed forces, factories, prisons, universities, community projects, and of course in prisons they do have a statutory right of visitation. Hundreds of primary and secondary schools are Church of England schools. Diocesan bishops, in other words, belong in a web of relationships in the communities they serve and have direct lines of communication into their societies at every level. People look to the Church of England, as I've noted, to provide a focus and a voice for the community at times of shared mourning and shared celebration. In many cities, it is the Church of England which acts as the convener for bringing representatives of different faiths together, and that is also true at the national level, where in only the last 7 days I've had experience of convening 3 gatherings of faith leaders on a national basis. And I think that will be borne out by an analysis of the Church's response to last summer's urban disturbances. All of this gives the established Church a capacity to express common values in a way which no other organisation is placed to do. The Chief Rabbi has said that if the established Church is removed from the public square, common values become more difficult to articulate. I think it's also fair to say that some members of both Houses of Parliament look to the bishops to offer a faith perspective, which they may sometimes hesitate to volunteer in their own right. These points I raise not by way of special pleading for the bishops in the Second Chamber, but to point out some of what might be lost if change is brought about simply in a formulaic way, and if we haven't addressed what it is we want the House of Lords to do before considering what composition and basis of appointment best delivers that function. I haven't here touched at length on the particular constitutional relationships of bishops to the Crown in England, or indeed the status of 3 of the named bishops in the draft bill as ex officio privy councillors. That's something which might need further discussion. So I agree, in short, that the House of Lords needs reform. It strikes me personally, and this is a personal rather than a Church of England view, that the package of measures proposed in Lord Steele's bill would provide a very effective basis for a revising chamber. But beyond that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to invite the committee's questions.
Thank you very much indeed.